So over the conference so far, we've heard many inspiring stories of struggle against capitalism. Indeed, struggle is an ongoing feature in this society. But on the one hand, people resist the system. Overthrowing capitalism actually requires much more than just resistance. A crucial ingredient for the successful overthrow of capitalism is the existence of a revolutionary party made up of workers who want to smash capitalism. And this kind of party is completely different to any of the political parties that we're familiar with today. One of the crucial reasons why we need a revolutionary party is the fact that the capitalist class has both organisation and leadership. As a minority ruling over the vast majority, the ideas of the capitalist class have to dominate over society. The capitalists, through their institutions, need to create a common sense understanding of the world, moulded, of course, to suit their interests. So what are some of these common sense ideas that dominate today? People were naturally competitive, selfish, individualistic, we're warlike, unchangeable, that's human nature. And of course, the market is the only way and the best way to organise society. The capitalists use their newspapers, their TV stations and schools to push these ideas. But even institutions like this esteemed Melbourne Uni that we're at today and numerous think tanks, both of the left and right, although sometimes coming up with more sophisticated and complex sounding theories, all start with the underlying assumption of supporting the capitalist market and system as the starting point and as the only way of organising human society. So ideology, capitalist ideology, these common sense ideas about the world are extremely important for capitalist rule and is the key area for why we need a revolutionary party to combat these ideas. I want to move on to another area of capitalist organisation and leadership, and that is, in this country, Australia, there's a number of like capitalist clubs, like the Business Council of Australia or the Australian Industry Group. These clubs literally are always trying to make sure that workers' rights are denied in a whole range of areas, always putting submissions in around trying to keep wages as low as possible. And let's not forget, and tomorrow we're going to be privileged to hear Richard Downes talk about the struggle for Aboriginal rights today, that the Minerals Council of Australia are at the forefront, at the best of times, in denying Aboriginals basic rights. These business organisations literally represent trillions of dollars. And when they talk, political parties such as Labor listen and serve these interests. Let's have a look at a couple of quick examples of where the Australian Labor Party has been put under direct pressure from business interests. This example came up actually in the last session, so for those that are around Labor and the Greens. But I think it's important for those that didn't hear that example. Back in the mid-1980s, the newly elected Labor government actually had a policy of granting national land rights, an extension on land rights that had been granted to Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory. Hugh Morgan, the CEO of the Western Mining Corporation, obviously had mining interests on some of this stolen Aboriginal land, threatened to withdraw investment unless the Labor Party reversed its policies. Well, under this direct threat of stripping away potentially billions of dollars in investment, the Labor Party capitulated and changed its policies. And unfortunately, those rights in the Northern Territory that Aboriginal people had also won back in 1976 were also taken away. And we see that direct product today. More recently, in recent times, we've seen Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard bend over backwards to serve the capitalist class with their Work Choices Light industrial relations policy. What is this? Well, the previous Conservative Howard government, they basically maintained most of his laws, including making most strikes still illegal today. Julia Gillard even bragged at a special Melbourne press club luncheon that Labor was in fact the party for keeping wages low. Although organisations like the Business Council of Australia and the Australian Industry Group are actually very well resourced and well placed to respond rapidly to events. And we can sort of see that they also take advantage of situations that emerge. there's a new common sense that's emerged in Australia recently around this problem of the ageing population. In a screaming February headline, "Big Business, Flight 73 is the New Retirement Age," appeared on the front cover of the West Australian newspaper. This article was based on a new policy from the Business Council of Australia, arguing that to keep the economy moving, i.e. to keep us having huge profits, we want to actually deny workers any pension, or at least until they're a lot older than today. Not surprisingly, what was the other piece of policy that they had put in this paper? Well, big business should have further tax cuts as well. But the capitalist class don't just control ideas and use their vast wealth to organise their control over society. I want to move on now to argue that the state is another key institution for their power. Far from the state being a natural force which can be bent to the will of workers, it exists ultimately to back up the capitalist class. At the heart of the capitalist state is control over the major means of violence, the police force, the army. Parliament does not control the state. Senior civil servants, the police, army officers, judges and the like are appointed, not elected. These sections of the state are far greater part. Their role, these unelected parts of the state and officials, their role is not to balance between the classes, but to back up the bosses. Their role is first and foremost to protect and legitimise the economic power of the ruling class. There will actually be a foundation session tomorrow at 11:30 looking at the capitalist state, what it is and how to challenge it. So I really encourage people to go to that session tomorrow for a further, more in-depth look at the state. So as you can see, the ruling class has a massive apparatus to back up their rule, which enables them to organise society in their own interests. Of course, this is a necessity when you have a tiny parasitic minority, that is the ruling class, trying to control and exploit and extract profits from the vast majority of people, that being the working class. The ruling class needs the state, the media, the education system, and many other institutions to back up common sense ideas that suit their interests, including many ideas that actually divide the working class, such as racism, sexism, nationalism, homophobia. And, of course, when necessary, they use direct force. And I think we can see that whether it's Palestinian campaigners, pro-Palestinian campaigners getting pepper sprayed for standing up against war criminals visiting Australia, or workers on a picket line getting, battened and arrested by the various police forces. The working class and the oppressed need their own organisation that not only defends the interests of the working class against the capitalist class, but one that stands for smashing the capitalist state, not having illusions in taking it over, that fights for the idea within the working class, for workers to have control over production through workers having their own democratic organisations. That is against private property and is for collectivising all resources. Today, unfortunately, pro-capitalist political forces dominate in the organisations set up by the working class and the oppressed to defend their interests. Take the trade union movement, for example. On February 15 this year, in an interview with the Melbourne Age newspaper, it was titled, "8-Hour Day No Longer Main Fight," says union boss. The Australian Council of Trade Union Secretary Jeff Lawrence stated that, and this is a direct quote, "The 8-hour day as the workplace standard is a thing of the past. We've moved towards flexibilities in a whole range of areas, and a lot of those areas I don't see us returning to. Things such as overtime, all these things. It's a question of how else do we address those issues. We need different ways of appreciating that the economy is flexible and much more open." It should not surprise anyone that the ACTU does not want to defend the 8-hour day or basic rights like overtime pay. In today's world, this is the logical conclusion of accepting when you accept that capitalists need to make profits, well, actually, which most unions do today, then actually you're going to capitulate. So for all that we in Socialist Alternative support and build our unions, we must recognise that they are not anti-capitalist, that they are defensive organisations which want to improve working class conditions within the framework of the capitalist system. This means that when profits are threatened, they will fail to properly defend workers' rights. So when push comes to shove, trade unions often push a common sense understanding that backs up capitalism within the working class. And let's look at a couple of those examples. A fair day's work for a fair day's pay. What does this actually mean? It's actually telling workers to accept being exploited, to actually that there is such a notion of going to work and getting paid fairly for it. Well, no, actually, this is a misnomer. The capitalists have to make their profit somehow, and it's through exploitation. Australian unions love to use this term since the 1990s of Australian industry being world's best practice. Well, what does this mean? Again, it's telling Australian workers that they need to increase their productivity, i.e. be exploited more, and even worse, in competition with those nasty workers overseas. So it's also giving a big dose of nationalism and saying that really you need to compete against workers overseas rather than actually being in solidarity and in common struggle. Obviously, the trade union leaders hold quite a bit of sway within the working class, and often their arguments are held with quite a bit of conviction from the working class. This is understandable, since let's not forget, what is the one power and strength that workers have? Their collective ability to withdraw their labour and so bring the capitalist system to a halt. The great attraction of trade unions is that they provide the organisation that can make this power effective. The problem is unions and their leaders devote themselves to improving workers' conditions within the framework of the capitalist system, not fighting for workers to take control of the system. So we have to be clear, although unions claim to represent workers' interests, they don't. They are very much institutions that defend the idea that capitalism is the best and only way to organise human society, but that workers should have better wages and conditions, but again, within and under the control of the capitalist class. I want to move on to another point now, and that's looking at, I suppose, the variety of different ideas that exist within the working class. And I think that every struggle, no matter how small or big, shows these differences. And you can sort of see that in terms of, like, there's some voices, workers, you know, urge for more militancy, for what want more strikes, can sometimes even oppose the more conservative trade union officials. While others can, you know, urge moderation, caution, can suck up to the boss and so forth. And this is clear at every election as well. There's a number of workers that vote for the Liberal Party. There's workers that are good on the question of same-sex marriage, and there's some workers that are hardened racists, for example. But this is a reflection of, well, again, what are the dominant ideas, who pushes them, and that this has an uneven impact on the working class. It was actually an Italian revolutionary, Antonio Gramsci, that pointed this out. He said that people can hold contradictory ideas in their heads, some arising from existing society, some arising from the struggle against it. And it's this unevenness of consciousness in the working class that makes a revolutionary party an absolute necessity if revolutionary struggles are to, in fact, succeed. A revolutionary party is needed to unite those who have the clearest grasp of the possibilities and to prosecute an argument within the struggle. If they don't, other ideas and political parties will fill this gap and hold the movement back. Even worse than I have, and this happens numerous times, lead movements to defeat. Let's look at a couple of brief examples to back up what I'm trying to argue here. Back in 1975 in Australia, the hardly radical Whitlam government was dismissed by the bourgeois class, you know, through the Governor General, for not attacking workers enough. Quite rightly, workers saw this as an attack on the working class. Why? Because the new government that's going to be forced upon the working class was being put in to attack the gains that workers had made. Workers across Australia wanted to strike and demonstrate and, kick up a massive fuss. But unfortunately, at the time, who were the leaders, the dominant forces that were in charge of the working class movement? The dominant leadership within the working class were the pro-capitalist ALP members and union officials such as Bob Hawke. And these leads were actually more scared about a resurgent and out-of-control working class, or potentially out-of-control, than losing government. And what did Bob Hawke say? He told angry workers they had to cool it. And unfortunately, there was no, you know, revolutionary party or alternative leadership really that could challenge this strategy. More recently, we've seen in the years 2005 to 2007, we literally saw a massive campaign in terms of massive stop work demonstrations involving hundreds of thousands of workers in every capital city and state across Australia and territory. That was against the hated industrial relation laws of the previous Howard government. Well, right through from 2005 to 2007, it was characterised by mass demonstrations and mass stop work meetings. But unfortunately, because there was no alternative leadership and the dominant leadership within the unions was pro-ALP, when the election year came about in 2007, their strategy went from, well, actually, you need to stop protesting and withdrawing your labour through these massive stop work demonstrations and just have to vote for the Australian Labor Party. And so, again, a potential movement that could have brought real change was channeled through, because of corrupted leadership, towards voting for Kevin Rudd. These examples highlight why we need a revolutionary workers' party. Socialist Alternative is not this party. We are a socialist organisation full of anti-capitalist activists involved in the struggles of today, but fighting for the need for a revolutionary mass workers' party. The Stalinist communist parties, like the now defunct Communist Party of Australia, earned a well-deserved reputation as a top-down bureaucratic organisation whose actions were at least likely to set back working-class struggles as to advance them. The monolithic Stalinist Party was a profoundly different political character to the revolutionary party Socialist Alternative is arguing for. Stalinism's roots lay in the destruction of the Russian Revolution. Workers in Stalin's Russia had no control over society. The same is true for the nationalist revolutions that called themselves communist in places such as China and Vietnam. These dictatorships never for the briefest moments had anything to do with the working class holding power. These parties have nothing to do with the kind of socialist party I'm talking about. The revolutionary party would be made up of workers, the most advanced and class-conscious section of workers, the vanguard. This mass workers' party would be very much part of working-class life, deeply embedded, involved in the everyday struggles, but at the same time fighting for and introducing socialist ideas. Its success would depend on an active membership who have hopefully learnt lots from the struggles, from all sorts of kinds of struggles, and in the process, hopefully, establish some authority amongst a wider layer of workers who have come to trust their judgment. So the Revolutionary Party is kind of like the memory of the class. You know, it's involved for a long time and learns the lessons of defeat and hopefully doesn't repeat them. The party would not just sit around then, waiting for the call for insurrection, but would be involved and be very much part of everyday class struggle, but fighting for and organising around the needs for workers' revolution over a very prolonged period of time. Because struggles not only show workers their own power, they also test out competing ideas and whether organisations are prepared to back up those ideas with action. So when Marxists talk about leadership, this is what we mean. It has to be won in practice and not just simply asserted. When there's low level of struggle, it can seem like workers will never break out of sort of passivity. But at key points in history, and when capitalism is a crisis-prone system, this impels and forces, you know, workers to actually take a stand, and we can see this right through history. And the situation can change rapidly. That literally throws millions of workers into action. The Russian revolutionary Lenin wrote about this sudden change during the 1905 revolution. That was the first one that occurred in Russia 12 years before the successful one. And this is what he said. In revolutions, there comes to light contradictions that have ripened for decades. Life becomes unusually eventful. The masses, who have always stood in the shade and therefore often been despised by superficial observers, enter the political arena as active combatants. Workers who have thought very little about politics find themselves trying to overthrow the whole social order. And I want to give you a sense, I suppose, of what it's like in these revolutionary situations and give you a sense of, because there are, have been numerous revolutions through history, the 20th century. One that occurred in Iran in 1979. To give you a sense of what happens during revolutions and how workers actually organise. The Shoras is the Iranian word for workers' council. The Shoras began to exercise their power at every level of factory life, in purchasing, sales, pricing and orders for raw materials. Different committees were organised to carry out various tasks. Guild committees to secure trade union demands with respect to wages, conditions, insurance, health and safety. Financial committees to control the incomes and expenditure of the individual factories and to watch over managerial financial affairs. Communication committees to maintain contact with shoras in other factories. Supervising committees to oversee production and sales. Political committees to organise small factory libraries to produce wool newspapers and to distribute leaflets and newsletters so as to keep workers informed of the latest news of their own and other factories. Guard committees, consisting of armed workers, to protect the factories from former owners and managers and or from counter-revolutionary elements. Cooperative committees, to organise strike funds. Women committees, made up solely of women, to press women worker demands, especially in the chemical and textile industries where women constituted the majority of the labour force. The workers were effectively in control of industry. They were discussing planning and managing the individual factories. They had control of hiring and firing. The Shoras were the key instrument for exercising power over production and distribution. During the first few months of the revolution, the workers increased production, doubled minimal wages by cutting the top salaries of engineers and managerial staff and provided free milk for the workers. So it sort of just gives you a sense that, like, when struggle goes well beyond, you can just see how society completely gets turned upside down. The problem, unfortunately, in Iran was that the leadership of the workers' movement was not revolutionary. So they did not see the task of the working class in this revolution as to smash the capitalist state and completely reorganise society using these extremely democratic shoras as a new base, but rather this non-revolutionary leadership of the workers' movement wanted to limit the working class to a what they call a democratic revolution only, meaning leaving the capitalist state intact and hence the capitalist mode of production in place as well. So revolutions can happen and do happen without the leadership of revolutionaries. What was missing in Iran was that the Revolutionary Workers' Party was a revolutionary workers' party that was uncompromising in the need and hence fighting for the idea that workers through, in this case, the Shoras, needed to take control of society and completely destroy the old capitalist state. The uneven consciousness and the spontaneity of revolutions explains why conscious leadership by revolutionary workers who have thought about these problems is necessary. There are always reformist organisations like the Labour Party that organise to limit the scale of revolutions or even to repress it in order to maintain capitalism. The struggle against them is not just some battle of ideas. To defeat the reformists and their capitalist backers, revolutionaries need to be able to organise political actions that involve the mass of workers. This experience cannot just be gained overnight. Long in advance of a revolution, when the differences in ideas seem less important and the struggle seem less intense, revolutionaries need to be developing an understanding of the revolutionary tradition and arguing and testing out in practice our ideas for what to do today. Because above all, we need to win other activists, workers, to a shared understanding of capitalism as the key source of what angers them about the world and as a form of society that will not last forever. Those who agree with us actually need to be carrying out the argument and constructing, you know, an organised network of people around these politics in our group, Socialist Alternative. It is at these high, because it's at the high points of struggle that the existence of a revolutionary party becomes extremely important. If it has members, the revolutionary party, located in every part of struggle, if it has won the confidence amongst a wide layer of fellow workers through argument and common experience, then such a party can influence the course of events. But this can only occur if the party has been deeply involved and is very much part of the class struggle well before some high point revolutionary insurrection sort of scenario. So to conclude briefly, the obvious case for a party, a revolutionary party, is that the other side is very well organised and has lots of resources at its disposal. The ruling class will literally stop at nothing to protect its wealth and privilege. To effectively challenge it, our side must be well organised and capable of mobilising millions of people. The overthrow of capitalism will require the activity of millions of workers in mass struggle for economic, political and cultural power. History shows the crisis-prone system of capitalism produces mass resistance from the working class time and time again, and such movements develop their own democratic organisations from below. And it is these organisations that will lay the basis for a new society. However, without the most class-conscious workers organised in a party, but grounded deeply inside the working class, that is fighting for the political leadership, with the politics of wanting to smash capitalism completely, that is fighting for the idea that the working class itself needs to take power and reorganise production on the basis of human need through democratic decision-making, we need a party that has a clear understanding of the state and the need to get rid of it entirely, and not just try and reform it or bend it to suit workers' interests. If the revolutionary party with these ideas fails to win leadership, then other pro-capitalist political currents and ideas that currently dominate will continue to railroad and stop any progress towards a successful workers' revolution, and hence we'll have to endure this indescribable anti-human system of capitalism even longer.